Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Richard Price, whose latest novel is Samaritan, now out in trade paper. Earlier novels include Clockers and Freedom Land, also the author of several screenplays, including The Color of Money, Sea of Love, Ransom. Richard Price, this is your third novel set in Dempsey, is that correct?
Yeah, it's a sort of a trilogy. I've written four novels before this. This sort of represents everything I've been doing for the last 15 years as a writer.
And Dempsey is a city in Jersey meant to represent any working-class city, though some have called it a combination of Jersey City and the Bronx. You grew up in the Bronx.
Yeah, I spend most of the time in Jersey City hanging out with people on either side of the law. And the reason why I did that was because there was too much bureaucracy trying to get permission to hang out with people in New York City. And in the course of it, I realized there is no New York City. There is no Brooklyn. It's just villages that, you know, encompass the same borough. So Jersey City could have been someplace in Brooklyn or the Bronx.
You've said that this trilogy, each book is a facet of race relations in urban America. In that sense, what is your overall goal, and will there be more books in the series?
I have no idea what my overall goal is except to, you know, just keep readdressing the subject, you know, different, I guess facets is the best word. And I don't do this by design. I don't have a great master plan, and I'm not even sure what I'm going to write next. I assume it's going to be something in the same spirit simply because that's where I tend to gravitate, and that's where I feel most engaged as a writer. But who's to say? Right now, I'm just writing screenplays and paying the bills. I don't have that many ideas for books, but I want to keep writing. So the way I keep writing is taking, you know, jobs for studios. So right now, I'm doing a couple of episodes for HBO on this show, The Wire, which I like a lot. And I've got about three screenwriting obligations.
Samaritan deals with a character named Ray Mitchell, who is a writer teacher. And while Ray doesn't have that much relationship in terms of personality to Richard Price, you have a very, very similar background. You did pro bono teaching, grew up in the housing projects, went to Hollywood, returned various times. What prompted you to give your character for this particular book a background so similar to yours?
In the last few books, I sort of kept myself out of the mix. I was writing about people and a part of American society in which I had left. You know, I'd grown up in a housing project, but I certainly don't live there now. The reason why I took myself out was because my first four books were somewhat self-referential, and by the fourth book, I was just bored to death, and I just felt like, I don't know why, it always has to be about me. And it was kind of liberating to sort of, like, become the other. This time, I went back and made a character that was kind of half me, because 20 years had passed between the last time I'd done this and now. In that time period, I had kids. So I felt like I had all these experiences and had a different sense of identity. So it was safe to go back in. Yet I feel at the same time some of the same problems cropped up. You know, when you're writing and you're using yourself as a source of material, sometimes your nose gets pressed too close to the canvas and you don't know when to get in, you don't know when to get out. On the other hand, some of the important elements of the character never get out of your head because they're so deeply imbued in your consciousness that you don't think of taking them out. You assume everybody knows this, and they don't unless they can read your mind.
When you say getting in and getting out, can you be more specific?
Well, if it's a character that's obviously not me, and I'm looking at them, you know, as a writer, they need to do things, they need to think things. I don't start spiraling. You know, like you do when you think about your own problems or your own issues. You know, there's nothing in them for me to become too self-absorbed about because they're not me. But when it's me, there's a danger of, you know, getting hit by a bus.
Is it therefore, say, easier to write from the point of view of your other main character, Nerys, an African-American?
Well, it was certainly a lot more fun. I mean, the seduction of using yourself as a character is that you feel like you're really an authority and you really don't have to learn anything. You can just go. But sometimes there's like a complete falling apart of discipline in terms of you're creating a fictional character. You're not talking to a therapist.
So to that degree, when you're working on Ray, you're doing a lot more editing and shaping because you have to.
Yeah. You know, in retrospect, I could have shut him up more. Let's put it that way.
There's a tendency, I would guess, in the same circumstance to look at his relationship with his daughter, Ruby, and try to deal with your own relationships with your kids.
Yeah, I mean, well, a part of this book is I finally gave a character a child. Not that I wasn't aware that children existed in the world before I had one, but, you know, parents, I'd never been a parent before, so that's what I mean, like this whole new sensibility. I think I did a better job with the father-daughter stuff. My daughter, who it was sort of half-based on, read the book, and she said she liked everybody and everything in the book except her character. She said she would never hang out with a kid like that.
Richard Price, the book is about a guy, Ray Mitchell, who decides to be a good guy. He goes back to Jersey, where he was born, and helps people because he's made a lot of money in Hollywood and maybe he feels guilty, whatever, and gets into trouble because of it. It's shaped in the form of a mystery, though it's not really a mystery. What prompted the entire idea? Was it the story of Jonathan Levin? At another point, you said it grew out of your own experience.
Well, it was a combination of two things. Before I started writing, there was a teacher in the Bronx who was very sort of charismatic and maybe stepped over the line in terms of like stepping into his students' lives. And it was a very troubled school in the Bronx. And two of his former students, I believe, sort of rang his buzzer one day, went up and tortured and killed him for his ATM card. I don't really know anything about Jonathan Levin's life. I know he was, you know, a son of, you know, very powerful Gerald Levin, I guess. But there was just something about how one can get caught up in one's own charisma and become sort of heedless. You can get caught up in how people are reacting to your charisma to the point where you lose a sense of prudence and appropriateness. And I feel like I have had and do still have that kind of same problem sometimes with kids. When I'm teaching a writing class, I mean, teaching the arts is very Solomonic. It's a very, you know, because there's no writing, it's not chemistry, there's no periodic table of elements. It's just your opinion and your personality and your persuasiveness, and you have people looking up to you, you know, for the big judgment. That can be dangerous because it can evoke a personality cult. So I'm aware of that, but I was also aware of certain other things I did in my life where I felt like I was in a position to help people. And I was just thinking as much about helping them as if I was watching a film of myself helping them. If you extend a hand to someone in need with one eye on yourself in a mirror doing it, how kosher is that? On the other hand, you know, I mean, even Mother Teresa got famous for being Mother Teresa, you know. I mean, there's no such thing as pure altruism. But it's that impulse to get sort of swept up in the drama of giving and people thinking you're the Lone Ranger. It was a mixture of stuff. And I would see Gerald Levin, like I said, I didn't know anything really about him. But it just seemed like a worst-case scenario for somebody that had that inclination.
In writing about Nerisse, what kind of research did you do into what it's like to be a cop in a place like Jersey City on the verge of retirement?
Well, I don't know. For some reason, when people write about cops, they always make them on the verge of retirement. I've done it at least 3 or 4 times in movies and plays because it's a natural crisis. It's sort of an ant and a grasshopper type thing. A police officer can retire it after 20 years and 25 years at half pay for the rest of their life, and all of a sudden you're 40, 45 years old. And you're going to retire. And the question is, well, what are you going to do? What did you prepare yourself for? It's just like a second adulthood. And when people have spent 20, 25 years being the law, and there's a certain charisma in that too, and there's a certain power in the socialized reaction to, like, all of a sudden at 45, you lose all that. What are you going to become? What have you prepared for? What could possibly have the juice? You got a person who is very conflicted and has a gun on their hip while they're conflicted.
Richard Price, there's also a class that Ray teaches. The stories that the children read in the class, how much of that came from Richard Price and how much of that came from the classes you actually taught?
Well, I made up all the stories, so they all came from me. But, I mean, I've taught classes very similar. I mean, he's sort of pro bono teaching in this, I think it's a public high school, which was sort of modeled on this school that I had spent time in, a couple of schools in Jersey City and Newark and in Lower Manhattan. You know, I was sort of trying to do my version of like a, sort of a bright but undereducated 13-year-old, you know, writing a very short 3-paragraph memoir, you know, in that kind of halting English and not realizing how much they're saying by how little they're saying about themselves.
There's also two characters, Salim and the second character is the husband of Danielle, the woman that Ray is sleeping with. These two characters are both kind of con men. And I guess in your research, you've run across a number of them.
The con man thing, it's just like on a certain level of society. Everybody's living hand to mouth. And Salim is a student of the main characters who's now 30 years old and had just gotten out of jail and is trying to get on his feet yet again. The husband of this woman that he gets involved in, he's also just gotten out of jail, but, you know, he's sort of a mid-level drug dealer, and that's what he does. But in general, I don't know if it's conning, but people are trying to, it's like a survival instinct. How do I make a dime out of this nickel? And sometimes you do it by playing on the sympathies of people who are in a position, you know, to give you that extra nickel to make the dime. Sometimes it's not so nice, you know. Other times people just sort of like fade on the vine and don't do a thing.
Both characters are quite intelligent and somewhat educated in various ways. And, well, they're both educated, yet there's a certain hopelessness involved. We kind of feel like they're not going, neither are going to get out.
Well, you know, it's like we all live in, like, shtetls, you know, and the shtetls are shtetls of experience or geography or whatever. You know, that's what I was saying before about, like, well, why did I pick Jersey City when I could have done some big, vast place like Manhattan or Brooklyn or the Bronx? I mean, because there is no Brooklyn and the Bronx. Everybody lives in their little village. And it might not be like medieval times where nobody walks more than a mile from a spot where they're born. You don't even know how hemmed in you are by your own experience. So when you have all the options in the world, you can only think of three because you've only experienced three. You know, it's a small world mentally. It's a small, you know, it doesn't make a difference how intelligent you are. It's about your experience and what you know of your options.
You're working on a screenplay of this book now, or have you finished it?
No, not really. I mean, it's sold to Paramount, and I'm supposed to do the screenplay, but I don't really don't want to do my own stuff anymore like that. I mean, I just, you know, it's sort of like doing Samaritan Light. I mean, I spent a couple of years writing a book, and I really don't want to sort of, you know, do the Telegram version. Somebody else can do it, and somebody else can do a better job than me because they'll have more objectivity. I mean, I won't know what to keep and what to take. I'm too close to it.
Well, when you're working on a show like The Wire, what kind of Bible do they give you, and what kind of freedom do you have within the context of your own work to come up with what you want?
I think The Wire is a unique show in the sense that it's basically run by a bunch of writers. I mean, HBO is sort of behind it, but I'm basically come on as a guest writer. So I'm sort of insulated from the quote-unquote suits or whatever. I just deal with David Simon, who's the writer-producer, George Pelicanos, you know, who's a writer-producer, and this guy Ed Burns, who's a former detective writer-producer. So I feel like I'm on eye level with everybody, but they've got it down to a system where you have 12 episodes following one criminal investigation with a certain number of characters. It's a series of steps. First, you have to decide what the season is about. What's the thrust of the season? Then you decide who lives, who dies, who's new, what actor you want to get rid of. Don't you think he deserves to die? Yeah, well, the cast does. Teamsters do. The thing with episodic television is that if you write a very early episode, you kind of have a lot of freedom because there's not much that went before you, and you have to be faithful to the consistency. When you're doing episode 8 and 9 and 10, you're in a straitjacket. You have to have down cold the trajectory of that character from episode 1 because you have to set up episode 11. It's not as much fun. I mean, but so we'll all bang out like what they call, you know, like the beats, like 35, 40 short scenes that will cover the hour. And then you break down those 40 beats into five or six characters. They each have their individual trajectory, but they all have to dovetail in some way. So by the time I actually get to do any creative writing, some of the creativity isn't coming up with the beats themselves. But when I actually have to write the dialogue and what's going to go down, I'm pretty hemmed in. You know, my creativity is all in a box. You know, each beat is obliged.
Are you involved with the original creation of the season, or are you just coming in here?
Well, they invited me to when they first went away. But, I kind of like to think of myself as sort of like an outsider. As much as I know about, you know, the world of, like, the trenches, the urban trenches, these guys make me feel like an okie. I mean, they really know their stuff. One guy was a homicide detective in Baltimore for 20 years. Like I said, David Simon was a police beat reporter for the Baltimore Sun for a dozen years. You know, compared to them, I'm a tourist.
So you're on the same level as Pelicanos then. I mean, I've read Pelicanos.
Yeah.
I've talked to him, you know.
Yeah, but George has a different level of commitment to the show. He's taken on the mantle of producer. This guy Bob Colesbury, who was the executive producer, passed away very abruptly. Threw everybody into kind of like chaos and sort of mourning. And what's come out of Bob's passing away is George has sort of stepped in on some level to take some of the producing burden on his shoulders.
You're listening to an interview with Richard Price, whose latest book is Samaritan. When you're working on a book like Samaritan and you have the freedom to bring in your own political ideas, I mean, it could come in from the back door unconsciously, mm-hmm. or it could come in consciously depending upon where in the book you're doing it. Obviously, you know, it's a little more conscious with Ray because that's closer to your character. Do you have any of that freedom at all in working on a show like The Wire?
You have the freedom of, like, coming up with an idea that they like better than their own. In which case, I mean, these guys are very good because it's their show, but they have a lot of respect for the people that they asked to write the show. It's not just like, well, I disagree. I think the character should be gay. I can come in there, though, and if I gave them a scene in which, right. if we go this way, what do you think of that? I've never picked up a sense of territoriality and possessiveness on their part. I mean, they're just, like, wide open. Dennis Lehane also was involved this year. It's like writers looking at each other in a room, trying to work together. I've never been in a collaborative experience like this before. Usually when I collaborate with people, it's like studio executives or directors or people that have more power than me. And these guys technically have more power than me, but I feel like I don't feel it.
So when you're working with Dennis and George, that's a really unique experience.
Yeah, well, I'm not working, you know, I'm writing my episode.
Right.
I've never been face-to-face with Dennis Lehane on this show. I see George all the meetings because, you know, he, like I said, he's taken on some of the producer's mantle. But I don't know. I just respect these guys. I've read them before I met them, and they've read me before they met me. So it seems like very un-Machiavellian, very un-Borgia court.
Well, when you're working on a screenplay for a film, very often you write the screenplay, you submit it, and then when you eventually see the film,
you go nuts.
You go nuts because it's been changed. Do you feel that on a show like The Wire, that there's a little bit more input as you reach the end product then?
They'll do rewrites simply because, you know, they'll get writers, you know,
right.
that will sort of know the turf, sort of like somewhat like myself and Lehane. You know, but the show has a specific tone. These characters are very consistently themselves for three seasons now. So David or George will sit down and then steamroll out anything that doesn't truly smack of the character. They'll change wording, or they'll realize in ways that you didn't know, well, because they're so obsessed with plausibility and they're so obsessed with the true pace of things. They'll slow it down. If somebody's going to get killed, they're going to take 6-7 episodes to kill them. So, you know, things will get moved around. Also, all of a sudden, because you're juggling, you know, 12 shows, what you wrote for episode 8, all of a sudden they realize, you know, the political beats you wrote here are terrific, but, you know, gee, I just realized it's kind of too early for that, so we're going to bump these three things. We're going to toss them into 9 and 10, and we're going to flip into your episode 8, 6 and 7, written by somebody else. But you could take a look at those episodes, and you can get a shot at sort of glossing them over. You know, you got to serve the higher purpose of the show. I'll be the author of the show, but there'll be a couple of scenes in there that I didn't write that somebody wrote for episode 5, and they were orphans until then.
Well, Richard Price, how do you view the political landscape now, and how do you view how television views the political landscape? We've been sitting in the midst of this right-wing Republican administration, and things have been shifting very, very slowly in ways maybe we don't understand or see. And I'm just wondering, from the perspective of someone working both in the context of working on a book like Samaritan, but also working in the television business, what you're looking at.
The impact sort of like in the urban trenches. I mean, I feel like, you know, there might have been a blip of brotherhood, like we're all in this together. You know, terrorism is certainly something that gets into everybody's consciousness. I think there's that, but I think there's a greater level of survival distraction. Guys I know that, like in Jersey City, I mean, yeah, the cops will talk about the pros and cons of Homeland Security and the Patriot Act and all that sort of scary stuff. But, you know, it's like when you're living sort of like on a survival level, that stuff is a little abstract. It's not completely abstract, but, you know, the things that you were dealing with before 9/11, you're still dealing with. They're more immediate. So you can have spirited discussions on any of this stuff with everybody, but I think thinking about Bush versus Kerry and things like that, it depends how much else is going on in your life to give you the freedom to be anxious about that versus how much other stuff in your life keeps you anxious.
How about in the world of television? Are you seeing it at all?
It's so silly to me. I mean, I see all these stupid shows now. What they do is they've taken 9/11 and they've made it a commercial premise. Now you got all these shows about like the grid and, you know, they'll do this token thing about how Islam is a truly gentle religion, and then they'll go hit on the snakes that we're really interested in. But first, we got to give you this little speech, this liberal speech about the Islam. But we know you're not interested in that. You want to know about the rats and the psychos. And then we'll create American superheroes. And it's just wish fulfillment. It's just, you know, it's something creepy about it. It's, you know, you're taking the horror of what happened and you're making it a commercial premise. And you're making people feel like we're going to kick their ass.
Have you done any other Hollywood work beside this particular one since 9/11, beside the war?
I've written scripts. I'm in the process of writing scripts. None of them are particularly political in nature. The only impact 9/11 had on my work, immediate impact on my work, I've written articles for the New York Times, like a post-9/11 diary of what life was like in New York City. I sort of co-wrote it with my daughter. I went out of my way to spend a lot of time with cab drivers, guys in jail. I mean, you know, people who you would take a look at on the street and go, there they go, there's one of them right there. And it turns out the guy's a Sikh. Or
right.
Turns out guy's like an African-American who's given himself a Muslim name in prison. You know, now he's double screwed, you know, because the native-born Muslims are contemptuous of him. And now the gods hate his guts because he's got a Muslim name. I remember when I was writing Samaritan, 9/11 happened. And I had a lot of debates with other writers. You're in the middle of something. What do you do? Do you put it in there? Is it exploitative? I mean, the world's completely changed. And I literally had a character whose terrorist looked out on the World Trade Center across the Hudson in New Jersey. I feel like you had to acknowledge it in some way. It's kind of writing about Hawaii in January of 1942 without mentioning Pearl Harbor. I try to sort of integrate what happened, you know, in some kind of unostentatious way and in some subtle way. But the thing is, like most artists that I know, their first reaction as of September 12th was everything they were doing was crap and self-indulgent. I mean, can you imagine being an abstract painter on 9/11? And then you look at your stuff, it's like, what is this? What am I doing here? And writers say, what am I writing? What am I saying? All of a sudden, everything you do seems so trivial and self-indulgent. But I think gradually what happened, it took a while, but I think everybody went back to the work that they were doing. And that is not like, you know, burying your head in the sand. It's because what you were doing on September 10th was important. You know, and then to throw your arms up in despair, it's sort of like a double 9/11.
But things have changed, and maybe not because of 9/11, but because this right-wing administration is in there. Has there been any change, say, in a place like Jersey City that's palpable?
And, you know, I think there's been a surge in sentiment. American flags will be everywhere. I don't think anything's really changed in the quality of the life or what people have to deal with. Maybe I'm being naive. Maybe I don't realize it. I mean, I was up in, was it Bangor, Maine or something? And I was talking to a librarian, and he had to give in a list of what every book that every, was. I mean, to say it's Orwell is trivial. You know, it was Stalinistic. It's all in the name of freedom, so it's kind of like war is peace. And some people have been waiting for this. It's a godsend to them in the sense that now we can finally clamp down on everything. It's sort of like the Palmer Raids in 1919, you know, like the first Red Scare. The other thing is I live in New York City. New York City is not really part of America. It's like a duty-free zone. You know, it's like Zanzibar. So I feel like what I know and what I experience, see, people in New York City feel like they're the most sophisticated people in the world. In fact, they're probably the most naive because all they know is New York City. And it's like the blind man and the elephant. It's like what you touch you think is the whole elephant. But you go 10 miles out of New York and you're the hillbilly. You are clueless. You're in America. So, I mean, my daily life is involved with people who are like-minded. You know, but I don't know. I have never been in the Midwest since 9/11. I haven't really, you know, talked to people. But I know it's become a very delicate and fragile stuff. I mean, before, you know, you could criticize the government and, you know, you'd have a little argument on your hands. Now it's kind of like you like hold your breath a little bit and you really kind of choose your words carefully because you don't know who you're talking to.
You don't have any direct contact except through a show like The Wire or, you know, just sending in screenplays. But Hollywood is its own little world as well, and yet they're exporting culture to everywhere. And so you wonder, what can they know, and how is this playing into what they're doing?
You know, in Hollywood, it's like, I mean, they're so obsessed with feedback from potential income givers. They take everybody's temperature every 2 seconds, and they will give people exactly what they think people want. I mean, Hollywood has never, ever been a brave place. In the late 30s and early 40s, they would not do any anti-German films because they didn't want to alienate the German market. And this is once the camps are in full swing. You know, we're about to go to war. No one would make an anti-Hitler movie. They all became patriots on, you know, December 8th, but December 7th and December 6th, they're walking around with big bunny slippers on.
Richard Price, you've written about race relations in urban America now through these three books. How do you characterize race relations today compared to when you first began working on Clockers?
I think race relations is always delicate and it's always dicey. I think it's also tied into economics. Hard economic times make for hard race times in terms of, like, you know, people having sort of sympathy or even an impulse for dialogue. I think in some ways it's better now. I mean, there was a period that was extremely strident. You know, when I started writing Clockers and Freedomland, like about '80s and '90s, there was no impulse to, like, talk across the lines. It was all advocacy. You know, people were screaming, Central Park, Jaga, oh, yeah, Yusef Hawkins. You know, every group had their victim. You know, and it was just a lot of shouting. And, you know, everything seemed kind of phony when they would have, you know, well, we're going to have a show with a dialogue, and our hosts are going to be, like, a black woman and an Orthodox Jewish man rapping about race. I thought it was a mean, ugly mood, and I don't think it's as bad right now, but these things come and go.
Richard Price, you mentioned economics there. Samaritan on the Surface, your other books all on the surface, seem to be about race relations, but they are also about economics and the economic divide in America. Ray Mitchell tries to bridge that gap from the beginning to actually the last page of the book. Is it possible to do that?
Well, you'd like to think so. I write about race, but I don't even think about it all that much before I start doing it. It's just go where I feel like going. I'm trying to write about, you know, life between the haves and the have-nots. And the fault lines unavoidably fall along the issues of race and economics. Is it possible to bridge the gap? I don't know what bridging the gap means. I mean, it really comes down to how much does anybody understand each other? Or basically, how much does anybody understand themselves? I mean, if you have a guy like Ray, whose impulse to, you know, to connect is very entangled in, you know, some kind of anxious vanity about being a good person. I mean, how much does he even understand what he's doing? And when he's dealing with people who are living in a hand-to-mouth survival mode, and somebody's putting out a hand, and you're going to snatch that hand, how much are you thinking about your big picture is kind of desperate? It's, you know, forever dicey.
You've been listening to an interview with Richard Price, whose latest novel is Samaritan. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.